But it is in Dublin we start this evening, and the new Jack B. Yeats exhibition, Painting and Memory, at the National Gallery of Ireland. Born in London in 1871, Jack B. Yeats, one of our most famous artists, prolific painter of Irish people, events and landscapes during the first half of the 20th century. By the time of his death in Dublin in 1957, he had made some 1,200 paintings in oil. And that exhibition, Jack B. Yeats, Painting and Memory, now on at the National Gallery of Ireland, spans 40 years of Yeats's work and marks the 150th anniversary of his birth. Jessica Fahey went along to take a look for us, and she's with me in studio now. And as we've been doing around exhibitions like this on the programme in recent times, we will tweet the images that we're speaking about, or some of them certainly, as we go along. I suppose, Jessica, first of all, in terms of Yeats himself, how is this exhibition organised? There's a temptation to kind of go chronologically, I'm sure, at one way, or do we go thematically? There are four rooms. How are they divided up?
Yes, so overall, and sort of typically with Yeats, the way to divide him up is chronologically, because he had three very distinct stages in his career. So early on, he's an illustrator and only paints in watercolour. And then in the mid phase, he paints in oil, but it's very graphic, very thick black outline, kind of realist, but very stylized in a way. And then his final stage is probably the one that people know better, which is a kind of poetic, abstracted form of kind of mysticism and, you know, those sort of works. So that would be the logic. And in this exhibition, I think what was so interesting is that instead they sort of start with the idea of his own quote, where he talks about that no one creates, the artist assembles memories. And they use that as a starting point to go through his career, looking at how memories were used and how he reused subjects over and over.
And do we get works here spanning most of his career? I know some of these have never been seen in public before, and that's part of the great excitement about it. But is it quite a broad scope in terms of the chronology at any rate?
It is, certainly for the mid period and the later period. So there's not as much of the watercolours or the kind of, he did a lot of work as an illustrator and cartoonist, those kind of things are absent.
Yeah, he worked for a magazine, didn't he, initially? Was it The Vegetarian?
He did, yeah. Virginia Woolf wrote for that as well. It was actually quite a kind of modern out there magazine at the time.
Right.
But perhaps more famously, he wrote for Punch.
Yeah,
as W. Bird. Yeah. So they're kind of humorous, they're tongue-in-cheek kind of works. Mm. Very different to what we get at the later period of his life, when it's, you know, this, as I say, kind of more mystical, spiritual style.
Well, let's go then through some of the rooms. And as you say, themes are really how the rooms are divided up. What's in the first room that we speak
about?
So the first
place
is important.
Places. Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we think about Yeats, probably what we think about anyway is the way that he travelled around Ireland and took these, you know, sketches and drawings of everyday life. And in particular, when he travelled with J.M. Singh, and this is, you know, something that we know very well about him. Those sketches that were made for illustrations, then later he paints in oils when he turns to oils. So we have him revisiting these same subjects. So, for example, in the first room of places, we have a lot of Sligo, because he was raised there, spent his boyhood there, claimed that Sligo is the reason he became a painter in the first place. But alongside that, we have works that we don't usually get to see. And we have works that show his way of sort of capturing a snapshot of Irish life.
Right. So I'm sure the people of Sligo will forgive us if this particular weekend we feature a painting from Mayo, given what's happening tomorrow in Croke Park. And this, in fact, is Fair Day, County Mayo, 1925. Now, we've tweeted that image right now at RTE Arena. If you want to see the images that Jess Fahey is speaking about, these are all from Jack B. Yeats' Painting and Memory, the exhibition currently on in the National Gallery of Ireland. So kind of a packed street scene really we're looking at here, Jess. Would you describe it for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So when he was travelling with Singh, they were working for the Manchester Guardian to actually record the congested areas of Ireland. So it's the perfect representation of the congested area of Ireland. And it's all about feeling like we're in the hustle and bustle. So the painting is a group of people on a street scene where they're all cropped and pushed right up to the front of the picture space, which
it's
makes
almost
it very
as if it were a, if it was a camera, it's almost as if the camera is walking through the middle of the crowd. That's the feeling you have.
Absolutely. And we're sort of seeing through the eyes of the artist. So just as much as he was part of this throng, he then, you know, gives it back to us where we feel like we're part of this. So this is a technique that you see artists even like Caravaggio using in The Taking of Christ, but more recently for Yeats, and perhaps more famously at this point, is Degas.
Yeah.
And that idea of a painting that looks like it's a spontaneous moment, that looks like the artist painted it there and then as it's happening around him. But just like Degas, Yeats, in fact, used his notebooks and, recreates from memory and from these little notes what it felt like to be in that scene. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is that the streets often in these works are, or the locations are still recognisable, but we see sort of element of what we expect of the kind of Irishness, like the flat caps and the shawls.
Yeah, and the mountain in the background.
The mountain
there
in
well.
The background, yeah, and always horses and donkeys and little boys running around as well.
And this is one of the paintings in the exhibition that is very seldom seen. This is part of a private collection, and you were saying to me before we came to here, in fact, most of these are very, very private collections, so the paintings are seldom seen.
Absolutely. In some cases, we don't even know whose collection they're in, of course, and it's just such a rare treat to be able to get to see them in person. And I think particularly with a work like this, because the whole point of this unusual composition, modern feeling to the composition, is so we feel like we're there, which is hard to do if the painting's, you know, a small reproduction in front of you.
And in the interest of fairness, we should say we don't think that Jack B. Yeats ever went to Tyrone, so we can't have a painting from Tyrone. But Tyrone, I'm the kind of the balance on that one, because Tyrone are my neighbours and Vermont, so there's the balance.
Very good.
I'm an Ulster man talking about the Mayo side of things, right?
I'm from Wicklow.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on then. To other rooms. How much did Yeats's own life, how much is that a focus of his paintings, do you think?
It's a really interesting question, and I think it's something that we have become obsessed with the notion of the artist from the Romantic period onwards. He famously didn't talk that much about his painting, but, you know, there are plenty of quotes out there. And one of them that I find quite interesting is that he, you know, said that no one could understand the full of any of his works, just as they can't understand any individual human's full emotional life. So this idea of us trying to find it kind of goes against what he was interested in. And he wanted the viewer to find their own, self or their own understanding or meaning within it. However, having said that, one of the joys of this exhibition for me was in fact seeing some of the works with the extra information of it, you know, very clearly being indicated by Yeats that it is a self-portrait, that it does reflect in some cases sort of dark time in his life, and that we get to read into that, you know, biography or autobiography within it, which is irresistible, even if it goes against his own wishes.
Well, in fact, because I'm going to skip on, because we've touched on that biographical end, I'm going to skip on to what is the final room. I'll come back to another painting in a minute, but let us tweet at this moment, The Dark Path. This is the painting, The Dark Path, at RTE Arena, if you want to see this image. This is a self-portrait. Now, psychoanalysts, get your couch out and get your pen and notebook out. Describe what we're looking at in this self-portrait.
It takes a second to realise what you're looking at in this work. So it has a huge amount of black, and it's very, very dark and very loosely painted, quite erratic looking. Mm. And then there's one moment of a sort of red and yellow that your eye is drawn into within the painting. And from there, if you look slightly downwards, you start to make out the edge of a shrub or bush and a railings. And then just below that, you can see a face of a person sitting on a bench. But
it takes a long time to get to that face, in fact, because initially I looked at it, this is a landscape. What are we talking about, a self-portrait? But yes, just in the bottom, if you like, what would be the bottom left-hand corner of that painting, just at the right-hand edge of that corner, there he is. Mm-hmm. He's a very small figure within quite a large painting.
Absolutely. And you see, this is the thing that made it so intriguing, is that, you know, the curators have done a wonderful job of bringing in just enough information to put these works into context. Mm. So we know that this is a self-portrait. We know that it was painted after the death of his wife, Cottie, and that most of his siblings have died at this point. He feels that he is you know, coming towards the end of his own life. So the darkness here, of course, is symbolic.
And also that just that loneliness. Being a lonely, yeah. the fact that he's such a tiny figure in this big, vast space, not another soul around him.
Absolutely. And it's sort of devastating, you know, when you really think about it. And, you know, it shows you that, you know, one of the questions that's sort of asked, as we already, you know, talked about a little bit, is how autobiographical these works are. And clearly what he's doing here is what we would expect of an expressionist artist, which is using colour and brush work to express emotion.
Let's go back then to one of the previous rooms, because that's the final room of the exhibition, in fact, isn't it, that we find that painting in. Bachelor's Walk, again, we'll tweet this now, at RTE Arena, if you want to see these pictures being tweeted as Jess is describing them. Bachelor's Walk, In Memory, 1915. Very well-known painting, this, and we're very much in the political world with this piece.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think for a long time, people have been seeking that in Yeats. They've been trying to find the political side. They've been trying to find where he fits into that sort of particular moment of Irish history. He moved back to Dublin in 1910, you know, so he's really there at the time that all of these...
Back from...
From England, yeah. So at the time of all these, you know, really volatile and, you know, significant moments.
Yeah, 1915 is pretty much at the heart of everything, isn't it?
Absolutely. So he's actually doing something kind of interesting here. And again, it's him taking a step back rather than being maybe overtly political. But there's no denying, you know, that he's representing here a very tragic moment. So what we're looking at is a painting of a sort of skewed sort of forced perspective along the quays at Bachelor's Walk in Dublin city centre. And we have this very statuesque woman who's dressed all in black with a black shawl dropping flowers. And we can just about make out the hint of red in her basket, but also the flowers to the right hand side. And then next to her is this young boy who seems to be stopped for a moment in contemplation. And what we know from his sketchbooks and from his diary is that he did actually come along at this scene where there had been 30 people injured and 4 people shot dead by Scottish borderers from the British Army after an altercation with the Irish volunteers, bringing in arms from Howth and just the general public, you know, sort of throwing stones and things, and then they open fire. So an extraordinary tragic event. But rather than show that, Yeats instead shows this moment of commemoration that this woman is dropping the flowers.
And do you think that that is an imagined scenario from Yeats there, or did he actually witness something like this in terms of the woman with the flowers?
So we know from his diary that he saw the flowers, not the woman.
Right, so that aspect.
Yeah,
the
diary actually has a wonderful drawing where you can see, the sketchbook I should say, where you can see the railings, and he notes that there was a bullet through the window. He notes where it was, and he notes that there's flowers that have been left there, which he says presumably that's one of the dead fell.
The final image that we'll tweet up now is from 1950, singing, this is Under the Canopy of Heaven. This is Yeats, I think, as many people will think of him. It's certainly the palette that I think of when I think of Yeats, the blues, the yellows, the greens, the reds, and that those lovely loose brush strokes, almost like he's dragging the paint across the canvas.
Yeah, it's almost like sculpting in multicoloured paints. This is a little bit more on the sort of live, light and humorous side, or at least it appears that way, I think, when you first start to look at it. But as with Yeats, there's always a kind of whimsical poetic title that changes our interpretation. So on first looking, it seems like these two men perhaps are parading. Certainly the one with the bowler hat looks kind of comical, almost clown-like. And then the one much closer to us, and again, we have cropped composition, figures pushed right up to the front of the picture space, that immediacy. He's holding a banner. So there's some sort of singing and marching going on here. But the title is the aspect of it that is singing. And then they are singing the song Under the Canopy of Heaven. So it goes from something that's sort of a fun scene of people, you know, moving through this space outdoors to something that you can read more spiritual connotation.
It's a very exciting exhibition, this, but we can't talk about the exhibition without mentioning the fact there's been much controversy around the €17 charge to enter. What do you think around that?
Well, I think that it's worth remembering that in Ireland, we have a National Gallery that's free to see the permanent collection, which is extraordinarily rare. I bring groups to Italy, to Austria, to the Netherlands, and you have to pay in for the permanent collection as well as the exhibitions. So in that context, I think, you know, we're actually not too bad here. The other thing is that there's always concessions and there's always times of day that you can go for free.
Yeah, it's important to say here that there's free entry every Monday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tickets are €5 every Tuesday from 9:45 to 1 p.m. So if you can make those times and possibly are in a situation that you don't have the €17, then maybe make aim for that.
And the price of, you know, insuring paintings like that that are coming from private collections, you know, it's really expensive to run an exhibition.
Yeah. And I suppose maybe the National Gallery are they making a point in terms of government funding? If we had more government funding, we wouldn't have to charge anything.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but very possibly. Yeah, yeah.
No, they would have to tell us if that's the point they're making, of course. That may be my conjecture. But you would recommend people go and see.
Oh, absolutely.
And do check out those concessions. There are discounts midweek, discounts for over 65s and individuals who are on wage. So check out the website and find out where the concession is that might help you and allow you to get to see the exhibition. Jack B. Yeats, Painting and Memory, is at the National Gallery of Ireland until February the 6th, 2022. Jessica Fahey is running an art appreciation course online. Yeats, an artistic family, and that it will be from October the 7th through until the 25th of November, Jess. And you can find out full details of both on nationalgallery.ie. 24 minutes past 7 on Friday night's arena. Now let's have a listen to one of the many Miss Dior advertisements fronted by Natalie Portman. This time it's on Miss Dior's planned wedding day.
Your flowers, madame.
It's Miss, actually. Christian Dior.
Natalie Portman there as wild child Miss Dior, skipping her wedding for a life of adventure. Well, the actual Miss Dior was the sister of the famed founder of the fashion house of Dior, Christian. Her name was Catherine Dior, and the iconic perfume was made with her in mind. The dark reality of occupied France is the backdrop to her very interesting life and the life as recounted in a new book, Miss Dior, A Story of Courage and Couture, which is written by my next guest, Justine Picardy. Justine, you've written a lot around clothing and around the fashion industry and the greats of the fashion world. Coco Chanel, obviously, your book, The Legend and the Life, garnering much praise. What drew you to Catherine Dior?
Well, I was so interested that her story appeared to have been forgotten, if indeed it was ever told in the first place, soon after she returned from Germany after the war. And she seemed to have been a sort of silenced voice. And my book is about Catherine, but it's also about the relationship between Christian and Catherine and about Miss Dior as an idealized version of femininity and glamour and beauty and hope, which really sees the world as an idea in the immediate aftermath of the ugliness of the Second World War, while also exploring the real life and the terrible, terrible, traumatic experiences that Catherine Dior underwent as a member of the French Resistance.
Yeah.
And then someone who was captured and tortured by the Gestapo in Paris and then deported to Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany, which was the only female concentration camp.
It's
where she worked as a slave labourer.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. But before we get into the nuts and bolts of that particular part, you know, when people think of the House of Dior and Christian's innovations, I think they're going to think about that post-war, that new look that he was very interested in, the sculpted jackets, the voluminous skirts. But what about Christian and Catherine? How close were they? It was a family of five. How close were Christian and Catherine?
Well, she was the youngest of five, and there was 12 years between them. But they were very, very close. They had a shared love of gardening, which they'd inherited from their mother. Their mother was rather a sort of remote turn-of-the-century Belle Epoque woman who was quite distant from her children, but the way to reach her really was through the garden. And then they became best friends. I mean, she really was the woman that he loved most in the world. They had a very, very close and loving relationship, as well as a mutual respect and a great tenderness for one another, great loyalty to one another.
And in those pre-war years then, Christian was developing his craft in Paris. Was Catherine close to him in terms of his professional development at that stage?
Yes, they lived together in Bohemian Paris of the 1930s, actually shared a flat together. And Christian, who had started out with the ambition of being an art gallerist, and in fact he was a very accomplished one, he was showing Dali and Picasso and other surrealists, and then this went bankrupt in the aftermath of the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, when you couldn't really give away a Dali, strange though that may seem. So he taught himself to become a fashion illustrator, and at the same time, while he was living with Catherine in Paris, he got her a job at what was called a Maison de Mode. And I also found these extraordinary pictures of her in the archives where she's modelling his very early designs in the late 1930s. But they were both interested in politics and art and music, as well as fashion.
Yeah, and the politics is where we really comes to the fore in Catherine's life in particular during the war. What happened when war broke out then? How quickly did they get out of Paris, or who stayed, who went?
Well, Christian was called up to the French army, as all men of a certain age were. And Catherine lost her job in Paris because, you know, the fashion industry sort of ground to a halt. She went to Provence, where their father had a small farm with rose fields there. And once France fell, as it did with astonishing rapidity in June 1940, when the Germans swept across France and the Vichy regime was set up and dismantled French democracy and worked infamously in collaboration with the Germans, Christian made his way back to Provence, and there they grew vegetables as well as roses together. And then by the end of 1941, when life was really, really tough because of the rationing, you know, the lack of food, of fuel, of the lack of anything, yeah. Christian returned to Paris.
Yeah. I'll phrase a question. I think you've just dropped out briefly there, but hopefully you'll come back to us, Justine. Christian is back in Paris. He's working in the fashion industry, and many would say, well, that's nice for him, while his sister at this stage joins the resistance. But many thought that the continuation of fashion in Paris and in France was in itself an important political act. But maybe you could tell me, Justine, about how Catherine became involved, first of all, with the French resistance. It involves a love affair, and I'm wondering to what extent did that love affair spark off this interest in politics, or do you think it was always there?
I think it was always there, and that she did fall in love with a member of the French resistance, but she met him because she went to buy a radio in order to listen to the Free...
Yeah, you're dropping out. You're dropping out quite a bit, Justine. You're saying that she met him when she went to buy a radio because she wanted to listen to the broadcasts around what the resistance were doing. At what point is she arrested, and how vicious a regime is she trying to exist under during her time in the Ravensbrück concentration camp? Yeah, we've lost Justine. We're going to take a break, and we'll try to get her back on the phone. Okay, we have Justine Picardy back, the author of Miss Dior, A Story of Courage and Couture, which is basically telling the story of Catherine Dior, the sister of Christiane, and her role in his life. But the part we were getting to before the line went down on us, Justine, was this story around Catherine herself being arrested by the Gestapo and shipped off to the Ravensbrück concentration camp. You detailed some of the tortures that went on in that camp. she was a very lucky woman to come out of there alive.
Yes, I mean, she was very unlucky to have arrested, and in the first place, she was betrayed by a French collaborator. But yes, she was lucky to survive, because very, very few people survived Ravensbrück, or indeed the system of what was called extermination through labour, which women like Catherine were subjected to, where they were literally worked to death.
How much did she talk about that period in her life after the event?
She never said very much. I think it was so traumatic. She a few things which showed, I suppose, how determined she still was to resist being dehumanized. She said that, I mean, she carried on trying to resist by sabotaging the machinery that she was being forced to work on to make munitions. So these small acts of resistance. Mm. She also said that she was just so determined to see her, you know, beloved France again, to see the sunset and the sunrise once more. And I interviewed somebody who'd been one of the few remaining women who'd been in the camp with her, and she was just 14 at the time, and she's obviously now in old age. And she said to me that Catherine was the captain of her own soul. And I think that what she meant by that was that she somehow maintained her sense of her own true spirit.
And the family must have been distraught, the Dior family, and then subsequently delighted when Catherine did actually make it back home. But it wasn't too long after the end of the war, a few years really, when Christian Dior died with his heart attack, and that left Catherine really holding the fort and holding the keys to the Dior empire. How did she, for the rest of her very long life, how did she marshal those, what was left to her effectively?
Well, interestingly, she was left with quite a lot of debt, because he was personally, despite his extraordinary worldwide success, he had a lot of personal debt when he died in taxes to the French government, because taxation was very, very high then, because the French economy was in ruins. But she maintained his artistic heritage, so she preserved every single one of his drawings. She kept everything that he'd ever drawn or made, and he named her his moral heir, which I think is so interesting, because she was his moral compass, and she represented the sort of integrity of France as well as of Christian Dior. When you think that less than 1% of the French population actively resisted, out of a population of 40 million, Catherine was one of about 100,000 who joined the resistance. So the other thing that she did was to continue to grow the roses that were used in the Miss Dior perfume. Yeah. So this vital ingredient in the perfume that was named for her, she actually grew some of those roses. And I think she found real solace in that, in tending her roses. But she remained very patriotic and honourable until the very end of her life, and a woman who lived life on her own terms.
Certainly,
she never married.
The captain of her own soul, as that woman said,
yes,
to you. It's a fascinating story, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on it with us this evening. That's Justine Picardy, and Justine's book, fascinating read. Some beautiful archive pictures in it as well, that are well worth looking at. Miss Dior, A Story of Courage and Couture. It is published by Faber and Faber. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be the British actress, singer and rapper Little Sims. Upward trajectory in terms of musical success and acclaim began shortly after her first independent album release, 2015, and it's just gone upwards and onwards since that. Next after that, we'll be looking at Saint Etienne, band formed in 1990. Sarah Cracknell, Bob Stanley and Peter Wiggs. They became associated with the UK's indie dance scene in the 1990s. Album number 10 is what we're talking about this evening. It's called I've Been Trying to Tell You. And finally, very different music, equally enduring Welsh alternative rockers, Manic Street Preachers, if you are to believe the critics, hit a real vein of form with their current release. That's what they're told. The current release is called The Ultra Vivid Lament. Simon Marr and Zara Hederman will give us their opinions on all three. But let's start with Little Sims. The album is called Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. Here's a flavour track called This Is I Love You, I Hate You. I great line. Maybe it's because you're in my DNA that I love you, I hate you. That's Little Sims from her new album, Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. I started to give the potted career, but it really is. Simon O'Aaron, Zara Hedderman with me in studio this evening.
Great.
Actually can see the whites of their eyes for a change. This is a meteoric rise, really, Simon.
It is, and when you think over such a short period of time, as you know, as albums 1 to 4 have gone along, but she got recognition from her peers very, very quickly. Started to get commercial success very quickly. Started to talk about that quite early in her career, and talking about the fact, well, am I really all that comfortable with it? And like so many, and that's why Sometimes I Might Be Introvert is the title on this, because the whole album is all about that discovery. Now I am a star, you know, but now there's Little Sims and then there's Simbi the person. And this is what this album is all about.
She has quite a lot to say, Zara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you were saying, this is a long album. It's 19 tracks and 65 minutes long. But she has a lot to say, and a lot of what she is saying is excellent. You've never heard of Little Sims before, it's a great introduction to her, because she is very thorough in detailing her background, her home life, and then even going into, you know, systemic corruption, the state of Britain as it is, and then also, you know, dipping into her career with a like nice tongue in cheek. You know, she's been at this a while. On her song Standing Ovation, she says, over 10 years in the game, I've been patient. And then she also says, now I've got to pave the way for the next generation. So she's extremely warm, very endearing, and so idiosyncratic in her delivery, and just the pace at which she spits out her words is phenomenal. And
then, as is often the case in a rap album, you'll get the little interludes along the way, which can either shift the tone or give you a little break from what you've been listening to. Let's take one of those, The Garden.
Humble pie is often the hardest to swallow.
I just wanted to play a little bit of that, because the album also opens with big orchestral sound there, Zara, and that lushness. And yes, she can spit out her rap when she's rapping, but she can also give you that beautiful, almost received pronunciation, recitation, as she does in other tracks.
She's a phenomenal storyteller, and you know, a lot of people would say 65 minutes is far too long.
I'd be one of them.
I live a little. But I think she is such a great storyteller, and the time just flies by with her, because she's also, you know, putting out references to, say, Amy Winehouse songs, who is a big inspiration to her. She talks about a near-death experience that she had later on down the track, and she details that so vividly. And, you know, she doesn't have to do that, but she does. And as a listener, we become very committed to her, I think.
Yeah, well, obviously that's how it worked for you. What about you, Simon, in that respect? I did find myself that this is all brilliant, but there's an hour and a bit of it.
There is,
And was there material for a second album here that could be held off on?
Yes, I think so. I think there's very, very few excuses ever for having an album longer than 45 minutes. You know, it should be old school. 22 minutes one side, 22 minutes the second. And I think she is self-aware enough.
Man in the studio.
But she's self-aware enough to realise that. And that's why those little bits are in there.
Yeah.
Those little interludes. And the fact that she got Emma Corrin in, she got Princess Diana from The Crown in to voice these things. And it's the contrast of
it. So it's not her doing the receipt.
Because
there are other little bits that are almost like little plays.
This is the thing, and it does make it, it does break it up very, very nicely. So we're willing to forgive her on this.
She also gives us this track. I just love that track, Point and Kill from Little Sims, featuring an artist called Obong Jayar, if I'm saying that name anything close to its correct pronunciation. This is part of Little Sims' Nigerian heritage. You were saying, Zara?
Absolutely. And she, what is great, and what, you know, you're saying with Simon about different albums within this, she does have three different soundscapes in this. And I really, as well, I loved the Afrobeat kind of inflection on the soundscapes. But with that, you have the like really smooth 90s R&B as well. Lauryn Hill is a big influence. And I think that all of the soundscapes actually work very well together. She complements them in a way, whereas any other artist could make it quite disparate.
I do have to admit, having said there are 19 tracks, and I was going, well, which one would you cut, Sean? And I found it very hard to choose which one I'd cut. So let's have stars from you, Zara.
I thought this was a really vital, very vibrant album, and it's a 4 for me.
A 4 from you. What are you saying, Simon?
Yeah, I think 4 is very fair in this. She really has got one of the most interesting stories to tell in music at the moment, and she's telling it so well.
All right, so double four there for our first album, Little Sims, and Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. Moving on then, 1986, Welsh band Manic Street Preachers formed. Enormous success with the 1992 debut Generation Terrorists. Tragic disappearance of the fourth member, Richard Edwards, in 1995 left an indelible mark on the band. Now consists of long-standing members James Dean Bradfield, Sean Moore and Nicky Wire. Album number 14 in their 30-year career is out now. It's called Ultra Vivid Lament. Here's a track called The Secret He Had Missed. Sister soul, never had the chance to reconcile. The Secret He Had Missed, album from Manic Street Preachers called The Ultra Vivid Lament. Album number 14 in their 30-year career. What are we getting here, Simon Marr?
What we're getting is it's a slightly introspective Manics, but it's as if they have discovered the last album that they released in 2018, Resistance is Futile. It was as if they were trying to be mid-1990s Manic Street Preachers, and that doesn't work for them anymore. So they've moved on to this, and on the Ultra Vivid Lament, it's obvious they've got an Echo and the Bunnymen record, and they've got an ABBA record, and they've put them together, and they've put them together with Nicky Wire's lyrics, and they've made a Manics record, and it's worked surprisingly well.
This is a short album, about that. We can't. There's no debate on that one, Zara.
11 songs, I think. But the deluxe, though, on Spotify is 23.
Are the 11 songs the same song 11 times?
They are. It's demos on the second half of deluxe.
Well, no, but I mean, even if you didn't have the demos, when you look at the 11 songs across the album itself, is there a sameness, is what I'm asking you.
Sorry. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. There is a huge ABBA influence on this, and I was actually very pleasantly surprised by that. But I was also really pleasantly surprised by how pretty this album is, and how they show different sides of prettiness throughout the arrangements. This to me felt like a real Friday night, very exuberant, very exhilarating. And then later on in the tracklist, there is a song called Diapause, which kind of has a bit of a wooziness, and that offers something kind of different. We also have Mark Lanegan, who sounds extremely like a late era Lou Reed with that kind of really husky voice.
That's a great song,
That's really great, and it is nice to have those kind of spots of difference, because otherwise sometimes it does bleed a bit into each other, but at the same time I do really like what I hear on certain tracks.
Quest for Colour, Quest for Ancient Colour, right? Julia Cumming who features on this one, isn't she?
Julia Cumming was on the track that we just played. On The Secret He Had Missed.
My notes are a little bit askew. My writing is one bit of notes beside the other bit of notes. So, but let me listen to Quest for Ancient Colour, because there must have been a reason that I had a little tick beside that. Bit of Quest for Ancient Colour from Manic Street Preachers and the new album, The Ultra Vivid Lament. I think it was the Eurovision aspect of that and the ABBA quality that's the reason I have a tick beside it on my page. Simon.
Well, it's very melodic. You could definitely say that it is.
Is that?
But I think the introduction of the pianos and stuff into it, and there's something interesting about the Manics, which I can't figure out. I'm not nearly smart enough to be able to say as to what it is that makes them escape with their credibility intact and make you want to listen to it again.
Yeah.
Because we shouldn't, because from a band who produced Generation Terrorist in 1992, or If You Tolerate This, Your Children Will Be Next, it should be too cheesy for words. But it's just not.
The right side of cheese, I think.
Exactly.
Just
the right side.
Well, how many stars does the right side of cheese get?
I'm going to give it 3.5.
3.5. What are you saying, Zara?
I'm going to go for a 3 out of 5.
So it's a little bit closer to the wrong side of cheese for you, is it?
Cheese is just burning in the oven.
Okay. Let's move on then to Saint-Étienne. I've been trying to tell you. How would you describe, Zara, the music that Saint-Étienne make?
Well, that's quite a challenging one. It depends on what album and what era you're talking about.
Confine it to this one.
Today they are mining some of their samples that they recorded in the late 90s and kind of early 2000s. And for this one, we have an extremely atmospheric, very, very textural. There's points where almost like Massive Attack kind of crop their head up. But that isn't always the case with Saint-Étienne. They've had albums that merge club dance with indie folk. They've done a very brash cover of Neil Young's Only Love Can Break Your Heart. So you never know what you're going to get. And I have to say, that is one of the most exciting kind of aspects to them. And with this, I have to say, I was very pleasantly surprised.
Let's have a listen to a track called Little K. We'd better open the theatre before you press the button, Sean. There we go, Little K from Saint Etienne, and that's from their new album, I've Been Trying to Tell You. I'll hold off on what I want to say, but I've been trying to tell you for just a second. But Simon, you are top of the class. As we were listening, you said that sample is
Samantha Mumba. Yeah, that's Samantha Mumba. Like Zara was talking about some of this sort of late 90s, early 2000s, and Natalie Imbruglia pops up. And then, but when I heard that one, I was like, this is madly familiar from somewhere. And I had to go through my list of Samantha Mumba records to eventually find it, you know. Yeah. But these things are all over the place, whether they're musical samples or samples that they've just recorded. And what they've managed to do here is, even though the album's recorded in isolation, because they couldn't be together, for the first time, they couldn't record this together. And it doesn't sound like it's recorded separately.
Isn't she on the Late Show tonight? What a pity we didn't bring her over and ask her. Do you know that you're on the
same?
I'm sure she does know she's on the Saint Etienne album. However, the album is called I've Been Trying to Tell You. Well, if I was trying to tell somebody something, I'd make sure that any lyrics that were in my songs were audible, that they weren't mixed so far back that all I'm hearing is... Well, what is that about? I understand texture, and I know I sound like an old man now, but is it not important to hear the lyrics, or should the lyrics then just be dispensed with and make vocal sounds?
I think when it's these kind of soundscapes and the breadth of them, and as you were saying, like when we were listening to that song, It's So Far Away, I really like that because that kind of engages me to listen a lot closer to it.
But you'll never make out the words, ever.
Never for a long time though, Sean. You might do, you might. But I really found that this was such an incredible album to listen to with my headphones, and especially in the evening time, because it really just let me switch off. I became completely washed up in it. And then I just was developing all these really intricate worlds in my head, which is another kind of listening experience with music.
I will admit that
important.
On the occasions I was listening to this album, it was the bright daylight, and I did think to myself, this is a wind down album, and perhaps I need to be winding down rather than winding up at the time of listening. Would you agree with Zara on that front?
I would, although I have to say, I was listening to it today. I had to walk from just the top of Harcourt Street down to Dame Street, and I had the headphones on as I was walking down.
And you were awake for the whole walk.
I was awake for the whole walk, but listening to music again, walking down Harcourt Street today, and the sun had come out. It was just I said to her and I described it. It was a blissful experience. I just thought it was just lovely.
Oh, there you go. It's like having the two of you back in studio, isn't it? It's all bliss at the moment. You both enjoyed this album, I think, possibly more than I did. Maybe I need to listen to it late at night rather than in the early morning preparing for a show. Zara, what are you saying in terms of stars?
Well, this was, I think, my favourite Saint Etienne album listening experience. So for me, it's a strong 4 out of 5.
A strong 4 out of 5. And Simon?
Absolutely 4 out of 5 as well.
You didn't agree with me on one of the albums. Never having you back in studio again. Go home. Thank you very much to Simon Marr and Zara Hederman there on Saint Etienne's I've Been Trying to Tell You, Manic Street Preachers, The Ultra Vivid Lament, and Sometimes I Might Be Introvert from Little Sims. Although I think we all agreed on that one, didn't we?